Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Aquarius Podcast. I'm your host, Randy Reed. The first thing I want to share with you all is that the guppies in the breeding for Karma Tank have spawned for the second time. And this time, the number of fry has jumped dramatically from 4 to 14. So even though I've increased the number of plant cover in the tank dramatically, I still did feel the need to pull this batch and was able to move all but 4 into the breeder box. My next move will be to net the female and give her a little siesta for a week or so away from the male. I think she deserves the break. I know breeding guppies is nothing spectacular, but hey, I find it exciting, and hopefully you all can share in my enjoyment. Now on to part 3 of What's in Randy's Fish Room. For this installment, I'm going to talk about the big tank, the 75-gallon. First, some equipment specs. I'm running a Fluval 2.0 Lite, AquaClear 110 hang-on back filter with a pre-filter intake sponge, Fluval E300 heater, and Eheim Everyday Auto Feeder. For plants, I have Java Fern, both regular and Wendelof varieties, Vallisneria, Anubias Nana Petite, Anubias Petite, Madagascar Lace Leaf, and a few moss balls for good measure. My substrate is pool filter sand, which I know limits the type of plants I can have thrive in this tank, but I do regularly dose with liquid fertilizer, so I think it's going to be okay. I have plans on injecting CO2 into this tank, but need to do far more research before I pull the trigger on any one setup. Moving on to the fish, I decided after going back and forth on what main species to keep in the tank to go with rainbow fish. So as a word of warning, I have tasked myself with learning more Latin names for fish, so I figured I should start with the ones that I keep. So namely, the main species in this tank are going to be the dwarf neons, Melitonia praecox, Bosmani rainbows, Melitonia bosmani, and my goal is to breed the dwarf neons to support a massive school of these beautiful, active little fish. As you may recall from my talk with Chance Perugini, I also have a pair of Epistogramma borellii, the opal variety. I'm not sure if these two have paired off yet, but they don't hate each other. And when they do decide to pair off, they have several coconut huts now and one terracotta Episto hut to choose from for spawning. Next up are powder blue gouramis, Trichogaster laleus. I started with 3, but I am sadly down to 1, and I'm fairly confident that the odds are not in my favor with this species, and the 2 I lost succumbed to dwarf gourami iridiovirus. These girls had a lot of personality to go along with that wonderful blue color, and hopefully the sole survivor remains healthy and can live out a long life in my tank. Moving on to the bottom of the tank, I have 7 panda corys, or Corydoras panda, and corys being corys are an absolute joy to watch swim around and sift through the sand. Lastly, a late addition to the tank is a bristlenose placostomus, and Cistrus species, not sure, couldn't really figure it out via Google, but this little guy does go to town on what algae builds up in the tank, but I make sure to supplement his diet with green beans. I'm really pleased with this tank and look forward to adding more dwarf neons and watching the plants fill in the coming months. So that concludes this installment of What's in Randy's Fish Room. And just as a reminder to you all, I would love to hear feedback from you via email, aquaristpodcast@gmail.com, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, I'm on it all of those at Aquarist Podcast. Thanks to those who have rated the show on iTunes and Facebook. I'm glad that you're enjoying the show. Now on to a very special interview with Lawrence Kent. Good afternoon. Today is Monday, February the 26th. My guest is Lawrence Kent. Lawrence is an accomplished fish breeder, having been recently recognized by the American Cichlid Association with a CARES Award for breeding at-risk species. Not only is Lawrence an accomplished breeder, he has also collected fish from across the globe, from Borneo to Mali. And somehow, Lawrence even finds time to speak at fish clubs and conventions and write articles for some of the most popular magazines in the hobby. Lawrence, thank you and welcome to the Aquarius Podcast.
Thanks, Randy. Thanks for the chance to talk with you about fish.
No, definitely. The honor is all mine. So if the audio sounds a little bit different today, Lawrence and I actually both work in downtown Seattle. So I'm at Lawrence's building, and we're meeting in one of his rooms. And so we're recording on a digital recorder. A little bit different way for me to record the shows, but hopefully it turns out. So, Lawrence, again, thank you very much for being on the show. And just as a quick background, what is your background in the fish hobby? So how did you go from, how did you get to the point where you're traveling around the world collecting all sorts of exotic species and breeding them at your house?
Well, I think I started like a lot of people did when I was a little kid. I had fish tanks, you know, not too many, 3 or 4, something like that, and tried different species. And I always loved animals as a kid and had a lot of different pets, all different types of pets. But then you grow up, you go to college, you can't really keep pets anymore, and then you go off to have your career, and the thing that kind of fades away a bit. But I actually went out to, actually after college, I went to Peace Corps. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in West Africa. Of course, I didn't keep any pets when I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I was helping smallholder farmers and improve their methods for growing rice at the time. But I came back and got married, got a job, and eventually wound up working in Egypt. And there, my wife and myself, and eventually our two of our three kids were born while we were living there. I was working on agricultural projects there funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. And we had we had an apartment, but it had some nice balconies. And I knew in Egypt, people like to keep pet birds. So I started, buying a few canaries and kept some birds. And then I found there was a market for cage birds. And so I got interested in keeping different finches. And then eventually I turned all my balconies into aviaries. And I became really obsessed with breeding different species of finches. And in Egypt, you could buy all kinds of interesting African finches. So I wound up breeding, probably about 15, 20 species of finches. I used to, actually, for Gouldian finches, I think I was, at one point, Cairo's biggest producer of baby Gouldian finches. So I would actually go out to this open markets and sell my finches to Egyptians. But then I noticed on the bottom of my aviaries, there was, I would keep sand, for the birds. And I realized, that's a lot of empty space. Why don't I use that to keep tortoises? So you could buy tortoises in Egypt, Testudo graeca, these Libyan tortoises that they brought in from Libya. And so I started keeping those and then breeding those. And then I realized, there was maybe room for like a Euromastix lizard. And you could get huge, beautiful Egyptian Euromastix lizards in Egypt. And then I got more interested in the reptiles. And so then I started keeping a lot of different species of geckos. And I made friends with these professional Egyptian reptile collectors. And then I started going out with them to collect reptiles in the wild. Schneider skinks and chameleons and all kinds of interesting stuff. So I learned something about collecting reptiles through them. And then that was my hobby. But then when we moved back to the United States, I also was keeping a lot of reptiles. And I could even expand my collection. And, I started getting into snakes as well. And then, but then my wife started kind of disapproving, saying, you have too many reptiles and people are afraid to come into the house. So I said, what if I got a fish tank? That'll be okay. Those are nice, So I started getting a few fish tanks when we were in St. Louis. And then when we had the opportunity to move here to Seattle, I got a good job offer. So I asked my wife, are you willing to move from St. Louis to Seattle? This is 11 years ago. And she says, yes, I'm willing to consider it, but one thing is for sure, if we move to Seattle, you're not taking any of those reptiles with you. That is going to be over. That part of your life has to come to an end. So that was a condition. And I met that condition. I sold all my reptiles and cages. I went to a reptile expo. I sold, over $3,000 worth of stuff. And then when we moved here, I started getting more into the fish because they were acceptable to the family.
What were your fish that you kept in St. Louis?
Oh, in St. Louis, I kept, like a lot of people, start with the general aquarium, but then I had, Chromita tilapia guntheri, one of those West African cichlids that's really cool because they're paternal mouth brooders. The male actually carries the eggs and then the babies in his mouth and the female guards the area. So that got me a little bit interested in cichlids. So then I got into the Malawi cichlids and then I got into Tanganyikan cichlids, and I started keeping Trophius at that point. Mm-hmm. It was great because, like a lot of people know, in St. Louis you have big basements, and so I had two 125-gallon tanks down there, and then a whole series of additional tanks as I got more and more into it. But yeah, more and more it was about the East African cichlids from Tanganyika and in Malawi.
Yeah, as the multiple tank syndrome continues to afflict me, I really wish that as we had gotten our house that the basement was the top priority. That the house that I found had a basement so I could be out of sight, out of mind with all of my tanks that I'm starting to amass. And I think my wife would have appreciated that.
It does help. When we moved to Fremont, and we had a nice, people said, you have an Issaquah house in Fremont. We had a nice modern house. It was only about 10 years old. But it didn't have a big basement, so I only had maybe three or four tanks in that house. But then my wife said she wanted us to move up towards Greenwood because the kids were going to school in Greenwood, mm-hmm. and it was just more convenient. And so she got interested in this really old house. It was over 100 years old. I didn't want to move. Mm-hmm. But then she said, listen, if we move here, you can have a fish room because there's a room in the basement you can convert into a fish room. So that was the deal. So that's how I wound up getting nice. A fully dedicated a fish room. And now I got about 25 tanks in that room and Excellent. Some adjacent rooms.
Excellent. Yeah. Awesome. And so just real quick, what are some of your favorites? You know, if you were to pick a favorite child, pick a favorite fish tank real quick or two that you have right now in your fish room that you're really enjoying.
Yeah, I got a lot. And I do like them all. But one of them, excuse me, one of them that I enjoy particularly, it's a 40-gallon breeder. And in there, I've got a pair of Hemichromis latornoxi. Those are jewel cichlids, red cichlids, and they're beautiful. And I actually, those actually originate in Ibadan, Nigeria, where I helped collect them. So I have that connection to Nigeria where I go for work sometimes and have been able to explore some of the fish species from that country. And so that pair, they often breed in that tank, which is great. They lay lots of eggs on a stone and then they guard the fry. So they put in a lot of entertainment. There's a couple of Congo tetras in there sort of for the upper stratum and some Nigerian red-eye tetras also in the upper stratum. So it keeps some stuff happening there. And then I've got a wild caught Chromatotilapia guntheri, that species that I mentioned to you at the very beginning, mm-hmm. that also comes from Nigeria. And then I've got this really wonderful pair of Steatocranus irvini, which is one of the elongated buffalo head cichlids. Mm-hmm. And most of the Steatocranus genus, these elongated buffalo head cichlids, they come from the Congo, but there's this one species called irvini, which is found in the Volta River in Ghana, like 1,000 miles away from Congo. So ichthyologists say it's probably not actually the same genus, but for now they just call it Steatocranus until they can come up with a reclassification. So it's a very interesting elongated fish, and the males have these bright blue lower lips. Mm-hmm. When I saw it in a book, that book that that Anton Lamboy wrote about the cichlids of West Africa. I saw a picture in there a long time ago when that book first came out, 12 years ago or so. And I said, man, someday I want to have that fish. And so eventually, after some two trips to Ghana and then one trip to Germany, I was able to wind up with a good pair of Steatocranus irvini, which I think very few people in the States have now. And those things have been breeding like crazy in that same 40-gallon tank. So you have big flocks of baby Steatocranus irvini being protected by their parents on the left-hand side of the fish, and then you've got the jewel fish, the Hemichromis species, on the right-hand side, and sometimes each of them will have a bunch of babies, and then they'll be very actively sort of sparring over the middle of the tank, trying to keep, you know, intruders from their side where they're keeping their babies safe. So I get a lot of entertainment out of that particular tank.
Excellent. Now, while you're on your travels, do your kids, do they help out to maintain the fish room, or are they cycled enough so that you can go away for the week and come back and everything's okay?
No, the kids help. Not because they particularly like fish. They don't, unfortunately. They're more of that, you know, cell phone, iPad generation. But if I pay them, they'll feed the fish while I'm gone. So my son, George, he's now 19, so he went off to college. Okay. He went to New York University, so he can't do it anymore. But he was my go-to kid for a number of years, and now he's passed the baton to my second son, Moses, who's 17. Moses, I think he likes the animals a bit more. So, but I don't fully trust them. So, you know, I get little Dixie cups and I portion the food and put the Dixie cups on top and say, like, every 2 or 3 days, pour one Dixie cup into each of these tanks. But it takes a long time to set that up because I've got over 25 tanks now.
Yeah.
And then the trickier part is live food, because I keep a lot of fish that only will eat live food. So getting your children to feed the grindle worms and keep the micro worms and keep the vinegar eels alive and then to sort through them and feed the fish, that takes a little coaching, and they're working on learning how to do that. But that's the key. Yeah, $9 a day is the price they demand. So whenever I take a trip for work and I'm away for 2 or 3 weeks, I gotta budget an extra $90 or something like that to pay my kids to feed the fish.
There you go. Awesome. So yeah, as I alluded to in the introduction to this episode, I mean, just from doing some research and watching your past talks and reading articles that you've written, I mean, I can at least count Over a dozen bodies of water, maybe even over a dozen countries that you've collected in, at least three continents that you've collected fish on. And today you wanted to talk about maybe some of the experiences that you've had in West Africa that you really haven't yet talked about yet at any of your talks, which to me is really exciting to bring some fresh content, given that you're such a traveled teller of the stories and tales that you have of your adventures collecting fish. So I'll let you go ahead and get into that.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's interesting you've done that background research, because now that you mention it, it's true. I haven't really reflected on that so much, but I've been blessed with chances to collect, you know, wild fish and look for interesting, you know, I call it sort of just like bird watching. I call it sort of fish watching, going out and seeing interesting fish. And I have done it a lot now in Asia. And then I did it in Latin America as well, in Peru and Ecuador and Central America, in Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And then, of course, I've done it in the States too, where there's great fish watching to be done in Missouri, Ohio, Michigan. Most recently, we went out and caught a bunch of beautiful rainbow darters. So, and been blessed with a lot of those chances. And then Africa. And Africa is where I spend a lot of time now. I go there probably 6, 7, 8 times a year for work. And then when I go for work, if schedule allows, let's say I'm going for 9 days and I wind up with a weekend, a free Saturday or a free Sunday, then I'll go out and look for fish on that as sort of my hobby day or my day off. Or sometimes if I wake up really early in the morning or I stay up late, I can go out and look for fish too, non-working hours. But I've been blessed with chances to do that in Southern Africa, places like Mozambique and Zambia and East Africa and Kenya and Uganda and Tanzania. And then in West Africa as well, in the Congo, which is maybe the best place of all to look for fish in terms of diversity. But then in other places like in Cameroon and Nigeria and Ghana, Mali, Burkina Faso. I've been blessed with quite a few opportunities to look for interesting fish. So in terms of...
And real quick, I would just say, I think it's kind of the world giving back to you, because your work, I mean, you know, coming from the Peace Corps, continuing to work in kind of humanitarian and efforts and to improve the lives of people in developing and impoverished countries. I mean, I think this is just the global karma giving back to you to give you these opportunities, because you give so much out there. And I mean, I think that's a really important thing for people to know about you. I think this has to do with your character and your heart, that, you know, you're a giving person, and that this is hopefully, you know, the world's way of saying thank you, Lawrence. Go out and collect some fish. And also, I do a little bit of traveling. I do it stateside for work. And when I fly in somewhere, even after 3 hours, I want to go to the hotel and just relax. You're flying somewhere for 10 plus hours, right? You land and you're like, let's go find some fish.
That's true.
So actually, I'm looking for the closest restaurant. So I find that definitely, you know, telling of your love and passion for the hobby as well.
Well, you're very kind, Randy. Yeah, I mean, we are, my job is trying to help some of the poorest people in the world improve their lots, you know, and most importantly, helping them improve their ability to grow food for their families to eat and for their livelihood. So that's the main focus on these trips. But then I get these bonus opportunities. And heck, man, if my employer agrees to pay for me to fly to Burkina Faso, you know, I'm like, wow, how could I miss the opportunity to also look for a couple of fish in areas where very few aquarists get to go?
And you're doing this on travel, on the travel days as well, and after hours. So this isn't like you're skipping out on a conference. Like, this is, you know, you're squeezing these in when you should be relaxing and going to the airport. You're out there looking for fish. So
exactly right, actually. It is true. I also look for birds too, by the way. I'm a bird watcher too, and those things sometimes can go together pretty well. You just have to look up instead of down sometimes. But in West Africa, I've written a little bit about collecting fish in Mali, and I wrote one article for Tropical Fish Hobbyists about collecting. It was kind of my quest for the African arowana, which is this big snake-like fish that's what is it called? Randy's pointing out we're running a little on time. So
I have to be very respectful of your time, Lawrence.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. But I did write one about the Africa arowana and trying to catch that fish, and eventually doing so in Nigeria. But since then, I've taken a couple of trips to Ghana and done some interesting fish watching there, most recently with my son, George. Mm-hmm. We actually went there just on a pure vacation because I've been working in Africa, well, for 30 years, and my son, George, he'd never really been to sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. Now he's 19. I was like, why don't you come? We'll have a real trip. So we went to Ghana, and we traveled around. And actually, it wasn't mostly about fish, but we did catch a lot of fish. Yeah, a lot of synodontis species and other small cichlids and keelyfish. It was pretty fun. So that was a good trip. But then about a year ago, I took a trip to Nigeria for work. And Nigeria is a funny place. You know, I forget. There's like 130 million people in Nigeria. It's a very densely populated country, very kind of crazy country in terms of a lot of people, a lot of action. And very, very few tourists go to Nigeria. It's got a bad reputation because it's got terrorism problems in the north. It has a lot of crime, and it's kind of a chaotic place. But it's also a really fun place, and Nigerians have a great sense of humor. And once you get accustomed to it, you can really enjoy the place. But on this last year, I had to go there for two full weeks. And so there was a weekend between those 2 weeks. And I reached out to somebody I've made contact with, who's a professor of ichthyology, actually. He's an evolutionary biologist based at a university just outside of Ibadan. And I hooked up with him, and he arranged for us to get permits to go into a forest reserve called the Omo Forest Reserves. It's one of the last sort of relatively untouched forests in southwestern Nigeria. Most of Nigeria, unfortunately, is pretty spoiled with overpopulation and pollution. But there's this forest down there that's still fairly pristine, and he had told me about it. And so we arranged that we would go there. And we stayed in overnight in a little place called Ijebu Ode. Yeah, that's what it's called. And some people in the keelyfish hobby might recognize that because there's a strain of keelyfish. It's an aphiosimian coming up with Biteniatis Ijebu Ode. Yeah, I'd heard about this through that fish name before I'd actually knew it was a location in Nigeria. But we spent the night there, and then we went into the Omo Forest. And funny thing is, because there's security issues there, they insisted that if we go into the forests, that four Nigerian policemen, each carrying an automatic rifle, would accompany us. So we're out there with our little tiny fishnets and plastic bags, and we're surrounded by these guys in green fatigues carrying machine guns as we penetrate into the forest looking for fish. And we found some really cool fish on that trip, pretty deep into this forest, including some small cichlids, but also some what are they called? Prokoptos? These blue-green little lamp-eye-type fish. I'm not really a keelyfish guy, but because of these trips, I've got exposure to some of them. And then we also got some of the Chromoaphiosimian Biteniatis, Ijebu Ode, which were in the forest there. And eventually got those home and have been able to breed them, and they're really fantastic, beautiful keelyfish. So that was a good adventure that I really enjoyed in Nigeria. And the good news is, I'm going back to Nigeria in about a week. And again, I'm going to be there for work, and I'm going to be there for about 2 weeks. And I haven't planned anything fish-wise, but I am going to be penetrating into a different part of the country called Benue, which I've never been to before. So I'm hoping if we get a chance while we're out there that might be able to stick a net into a stream or two and see if we can find something interesting when we're out there.
Anything in particular that you would be targeting or at least hoping to pull up in the net when you go out there?
No, at this point, I can't really answer that. No, I think it's more like let's just go take a look and see what we can find. I guess keelyfish are the ones that first come to mind because the keelyfish people are always looking for stuff from new locations, and they do differentiate so much by one spot to the mm-hmm. next. But yeah, I'll be very open-minded and see what we can get.
Yeah, very awesome. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Let's see, how are we doing on time? So we've got 5 minutes to go. So just to kind of wrap this up, so I think there's obviously a lot of content and a lot of really cool information and presentations out there about collecting fish in Africa, at least from the, hey, here's the location, these are the fish that are there. But in your experience, you know, having lived in Africa, having raised a family in Africa, and continually going back there, you know, what are, because not a lot of Americans travel overseas, and then not a lot of them go to Africa. So if somebody listening to this is like, you know what, yeah, there's some beautiful fish there, I want to go to Africa, what would you say are some things to, when traveling to that region, people should be aware of, or what will help them really be successful?
Well, there's great places to go in Africa, to go on a safari, to go look for, you know, the big animals, the big mammals, and the beautiful birds. That's what most people do, and that's a fantastic way to spend a vacation. And the places people most commonly go to are, you know, in Kenya, the Serengeti, in northern Tanzania, wonderful game parks there, bring in a lot of tourists, mostly from Europe, but also from the States. And then in South Africa, excuse me. In South Africa, a lot of American tourists go to South Africa as well. Sometimes they penetrate a little bit further north up into Botswana, where there's great big game to look at. But those aren't the best places to look for fish. Particularly South Africa, it's a relatively, you know, it's not truly tropical. It's semi-tropical there, so you don't have as great a diversity of interesting fish. There are some interesting fish there, but it's not the best place to go. And then if you go up into Kenya or Tanzania, there are opportunities there. Of course, if you go into Western Kenya, you'd be on Lake Victoria. And in Lake Victoria, you can easily find fishermen who can show you haplochromines that they've caught, or even arrange for you to go out with them to capture haplochromines with them, usually using cast nets. That's something I often do when I'm on the Ugandan side of Lake Victoria. And similarly, if you're in Tanzania, the game parks are in the north, and then if you go a little bit further to the northwest, then you can get to Lake Victoria, which you could follow the same approach. And if you go a little further west, well, actually, it's pretty big country, so you have to travel a while to get there. You can get to Lake Tanganyika. And first time I went to Lake Tanganyika, I couldn't believe how easy it was. You know, I met Ad Konings, mm-hmm. the cichlid expert, and I told him sometimes I go to Tanzania, where could I go look for fish? And he said, oh, you could try Kigoma. And I said, okay, have you ever been there? He's like, no, I've never been there, but it's right on the lake. I heard you can go there. So I bought a ticket to fly into Kigoma. When I got there, I checked into this little local hotel. The lake was right there. I ran down to the lake, put on a mask, jumped in the water, and it was like you're in the most beautiful Lake Tanganyika fish tank you'd ever seen, surrounded by like a dozen species that you already know from your home aquarium. Mm-hmm. And it was so easy there to find so many different species. So That is an option. I think those are probably some of the easier options for looking for fish. Otherwise, people organize specific trips to go to Lake Malawi, and I've done that several times too. And there you can arrange, actually get a little cottage on lakeside, or even there's even some islands on the lake which you can they have hotels on that we can go to, and they can arrange for you to go out snorkeling and see, you know, the absolutely gorgeous and diverse fish in the clear waters of Lake Malawi. Mm-hmm. That would be a specific probably Malawi trip. But I think if you do the more typical thing for American tourists and go look for the big game safaris in East Africa, in Kenya or Tanzania, with a little bit of preparation and a few phone calls, you probably can tack on a few days also looking for interesting fish.
Find the fishermen, bring your book with the picture reference, right? Don't rely on your phone with Wi-Fi to show them, and they'll take care of the rest. And then obviously what local currency will just to help kind of, you know, hey, here's some money for your troubles.
Exactly.
Help me find some fish. Awesome.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You just wind up tipping people a little bit, you know, $20 or something like that for a half day of them taking you around, showing you, helping you catch fish. And bringing a book with you and showing pictures always gets a lot of interest. A bunch of fishermen and their friends will gather around, start looking at your books, and oh, we've got this one. I can find that one. No, we don't have this one. And then when they point to the one and say, we've got this one, you say, well, let's go get it. And
awesome.
Then they say, come on. And then your adventure begins.
Awesome. Lawrence, this has been an excellent talk. I wish I could keep you in this room for another 3 hours, but I definitely want to be conscious of your time. And I thank you so much. And I hope everybody out there listening to this, Lawrence is fantastic. Look for his articles. Keep up and see all the good content that he's putting out and the beautiful fish that he finds. So, Lawrence, thank you very much. And hopefully I can have you on again in the future.
Yeah, my pleasure, Andy. Thank you.
I really hope you all enjoyed that interview as much as I enjoyed being there in person with Lawrence to talk to him about his experiences in Africa, keeping all sorts of wild critters, breeding all sorts of animals, and then his progression into the fish keeping hobby, and then his experiences all over Africa catching fish. Like I said in the interview, you know, I wish I could have had Lawrence for another 3 hours to just record and just talk to him and pick his brain on all of the cool and exciting trips that he's been on, and his time catching fish out there in all the various countries and not just in Africa. I definitely hope to have Lawrence on again in the future, and I'm thrilled to say that, you know, I belong to a fish club that has members like Lawrence Kent in their ranks. So, you know, it's a true blessing and a true honor to be able to interview a guy like Lawrence Kent, and that he would take his time out to have lunch and, you know, talk to me for almost a half hour about fish. So, super cool. Again, I hope you all really, really enjoyed it. If you did like it, please subscribe to this podcast, share it with all your fish nerd friends, rate it on iTunes, rate it on Facebook, wherever you can. Help me grow the listener base of this show. We are international in Canada, Portugal, Germany, the United Kingdom. So really cool to see a global listener base to this little podcast. I appreciate everybody out there tuning in. Until next time, thank you very much.